Hi, I'm Xian Qi, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival, and you're listening to our Mind Spa podcast series recorded live at the Byron Writers Festival 2023. In this session, titled The Art of Noticing, Susan Johnson, Maggie McKellar, and Peter Politis engage in an inspiring conversation with Jill Eddington.
Welcome, everyone, to this very early morning session. I have to say, when we all spoke, we're not going to have anyone there, but look at this. How fabulous. So thank you for making the effort to be here. And welcome, of course, to the last day of the Byron Writers Festival, held on the glorious land of the Bundjalung Nation. Let me and all of us pay our respects to elders past, present and future, and to the original storytellers of this nation. I'm Jill Eddington, and I'm thrilled to be here today to chair this session with these three fabulous writers. It's called The Art of Noticing. So we're going to try and focus a little bit on that today, the noticing of what goes on in the writer's mind. Let me introduce you quickly to these writers if you don't know them. In the middle, bookended, is Peter Politis, a novelist from Western Sydney, who made a huge splash on the literary scene with his first novel, Down the Hume. And his latest book is called God Forgets About the Poor. On the far side, over the other one, I think she can hear me, Maggie McKellar is a writer of four previous books and a farmer. Her most recent book, Graft, Motherhood, Family and A Year on the Land, is a beautiful reflection on what it means to be human. And next to me, Susan Johnson, a much awarded author of over a dozen books and mostly fiction. Aphrodite's Breath, her latest publication, is a poignant story of time spent with her mother in Greece. Please join me in welcoming Maggie, Peter and Susan. So just a little bit of an insight. The narrative thread of each of these three books is really propelled by close observation and the minutiae of everyday life. Be it human behaviour, be it relationships, be it family, be it motherhood, nature, landscape, seasons. There's just this continuity of the minutiae going on in the three books, and it's really fascinating to read them. I was just saying, as a suite of books, actually, they all seem to riff and feed off each other whilst very different in style. They're very personal books, family stories and reflections, and we feel like we get an insight into the reader as well as the stories. So what I want to do before we talk about noticing as such, I wanted each of the writers to just give you a little sense of the book and in a few words, and indeed each of them has one of the most beautiful introductions you would ever read. So I'm just going to ask them to share that with you and give you a sense of their voice. So Susan, we might hit off with you if that's okay.
This is from the prologue. In life and in myth, women are the ones who are supposed to stay home, like Penelope, weaving at their looms, rather than leaving home, like Odysseus. This is a story of two women at the reckoning end of life, leaving their homes for the Greek island of Kythera. We took ourselves off without armies or kingdoms, modern-day heroines to no one. It seems miraculous now, believing ourselves freightless, divested of troubles. We knew we were privileged in that we could leave home at all, since most souls in this world are tethered by the quotidian restraints of existence. We counted ourselves blessed in being able to choose a different route to the one prescribed, a path more usually trod by men, and by that I mean the path of desire. If men cover the universe with drawings they have lived, as Gaston Blachelard wrote, we wish to trace our own map, to follow nothing but the wind of our desires.
Thank you. Thanks, Susan. You, just to give us a little picture, you and your mum head off to Kythera.
Yes. I was 62 at the time and Mum was 85. She was a very independent, active 85, but nonetheless she was 85. And most people wouldn't want to uproot their lives and go and live at the other end of the earth in a culture in which they have no language, but Mum was prepared to do that. So we took off together, yep. And it's the story of our journey. And an unexpected story, really, because it didn't really go as we had planned.
No, it somewhat unravelled rather than... And Peter, could you share with us yours? And Peter's book has just come out. I've got the uncorrected proof, which I read. Looks like this. And now here's the real one, which is gorgeous.
Start when I was born. Describe the village and how beautiful it was. On the side of a mountain, but in the middle of a forest. If we walked to a certain point on the edge, we could look over the valley and see the rain clouds coming. Sometimes we would see a cat on a roof. We would read that as a warning of a storm. When we looked down, we saw the dirt, which was just as rich as the sky. My island, your island, our island. It's named after the white rocks at the mountain peak. It's those same rocks that make the ground full of nitrate and natural fertilizer. Set the story there. This is a geography, but start with the day I was born. Add salt and pepper and fat. Say that the October rains were creating a fine mist on the day, that it turned the air to glass, that something in the weather was special. Make it magical in the way that artists do. You're supposed to be a writer. Try and write something good this time. Be interesting.
And this is your mother's voice and your mother's story.
Yeah. After I won a tiny little award for my second book, my mum demanded that I write a book about her life.
She thought it was more interesting than yours, perhaps.
Yeah, she kept on... It's a constant refrain in the book is you just have to stop writing your gay things. But, you know, what's gay about a son writing about his mother?
She's a very endearing character. And we'll come back more to your mother later. Thank you. Maggie, as it happens, your introduction is also a perfect little way of introducing the readers to your book. Would you share that with us and tell us about the genesis of your book too?
I just want to say I feel so lucky being here. I've been down on your beaches and it is just the water up here is so beautiful and it's just been such a treat to be here.
Maggie's from Tasmania. Yeah. She's warm.
I think the water's about 10 to 12 degrees warmer. It's quite an act to follow, Peter. This story starts 20 years ago with the birth of my son. When he was only hours old, my mother and my friend whispered their leave and left he and I to learn each other. In the quiet, the spectra of my husband's death only 10 weeks earlier hovered over us. I lay in that bed and looked into the dark, and then I turned and looked at my perfect baby. In every memory of this moment, I whisper words of encouragement, and my 28-year-old self reaches for that baby and believes my 38-year-old self, my 48-year-old self, my 60-year-old self. All of these women whispering back to that young woman, don't panic. Pick up the baby. Run your lips over his down. Let each perfect feature, the depth in his eyes, the quiet intensity of him fill you. Tell him he's safe. Tell him you are too.
Thanks, Megan. You decide to write this book when your son is leaving home.
20 years after that moment.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, and it's based around a lambing diary I kept during the 2018-19 drought, which was a dreadful lambing. I come from a fine wool merino farm on the east coast of Tasmania, and in order to try and make sense of what we were dealing with, I kept a diary that ended up being 180,000 words long that I distilled into, I think, about 3,000 words of it into the actual book. But yeah, that's the backbone of this book. But it's really about mothering and about letting go and about identity. I think using the focus on sheep and animals and the world around us, trying to destabilize the order of
the way that we order things in our own heads.
It's amazing as a reader how much empathy you allow us to have for the sheep and their mothering, and actually gives us insight into our own motherhood and mothers, which is wonderful. So let's discuss this notion of the art of noticing. Surely it's the writer's lot to notice. Is that what you guys do that the rest of us don't?
Well, I think yes. I think it is part of the job description, and I think every writer I know is interested in looking at what is going on underneath, what the surface is. And I think certainly I know that my mother used to say when I was young, when I was a baby even, I would just look at everything and be very sort of somber. And my son Elliot, who's now 26, had the same. Like, I couldn't take him out in public for a period because he'd just look at someone and and I'd say, Elliot. And, you know, if you're on the train or a bus, and apparently I was like that too. So yeah. I think I am interested in looking, and I think that is a particularly writerly skill in noticing things. I'm a very good eavesdropper. I notice things that other people don't notice, I think. But I think it's because, in my experience, writers very early have a sense of what we're being told about the world is not necessarily what is happening, or what we can see in front of us is not necessarily happening. So many writers have complicated family situations to start with, and they're familiar with the notion that there's something else there. So I think you sort of train yourself to watch and notice what is really happening. I'm being told something, but it's not necessarily what is happening. So I think that, to me, it would be the writerly thing that I would say about myself and what I have noticed in other writers. We do pick up things that other people don't necessarily see. That's my experience. I mean, I think, everyone notices that we are sensate beings. You know, nothing distinct, you know, writers don't have, you know, a superpower unlike non-writers, but I think it does become more honed as you continue to write.
Interesting.
Do you think that...
Yeah, Peter, how would you respond to that?
I want to speak to that because, you know, there's that clichéd quote that we know of James Baldwin, which is, no one suffered as much as you until you've read a book and then you realise... what suffering
yeah,
is.
Yes.
And everyone quotes that a lot. But for me, the biggest thing about reading James Baldwin for me was when I read his autofiction, I remember him just describing everyday scenarios, but describe them in a way where he added almost an unfathomable depth to the minutiae of a family's interaction. And I think that's part of the power of... or what you want to convey in language, you really want to convey the idea that there's just so much going on that's just even beyond the surface experience. And you can only do that via noticing.
Are you conscious of that when you're writing?
Yeah, very much so. But part of noticing as well is the predetermined prejudices that you bring to an experience and how you interpret it. So, for example, I'm currently really obsessed with Jung and the psychologist. And I'm interested in his kind of notions of archetypes, whether or not that can be applied to people or not in this era is different. But I kind of see myself interpreting the framework through those mythical archetypes.
And Maggie, your thoughts on that?
My older brother is autistic, profoundly autistic, and I talk about that a little bit in the book. He has no spoken language, and he is very reactive to sound, feeling, things that other people would not necessarily pick up on or see, and it's as if his world is unfiltered and it comes into him. He's 16 months older than I am, and I think that as I was writing this book, I realised how profoundly that experience of growing up with somebody who interpreted and experienced the world so differently outside of language and who couldn't use language to explain what he was seeing, feeling, hearing, taught me to move through the world differently because I was constantly on alert as to what would set him off or what would upset him or what would please him. And it felt like it was like a shortcut to noticing the layers of the world in a different way.
Mm.
And then, of course, living on a farm where you're away from people, where your world is the natural world and where you are learning to, where your movement affects the way animals move, and again brings another layer to my writing, I think, and to the way that I'm noticing things. And it's that sort of thing of like, oh, we're so self-important, we're so in at the top of the apex of the world, but as soon as you stop, you begin to see that that's not necessarily the way. Mm. That is a really roundabout way of answering your question.
No, and it's really interesting because whilst he plays a very minor part in the content of the book, your brother's presence is so strong, and the empathy with which you wrote him is extraordinary, and the truth, the honesty too about it. So, and yeah, you really feel it as a reader. I just wanted to ask all three of you now, these books are, they're not, well, I don't know, you can tell me. Yours says it's a novel, Peter, but I'm wondering, is it a novel? How would you classify? Do we need to classify it? Is it memoir, autofiction? How would you...
Yeah, I think it lends itself to the autofiction genre, but I call it biofiction, so biographical fiction, but also bio because it's kind of... I think it lends itself to the ecologically queer texts that exist in this era, so I call it biofic.
Okay, and it's biofic because it's you're inhabiting your mother's voice. I think you were saying that earlier.
Yeah, I found it really interesting because, you know, you start, like, that beautiful piece that you read out, that is totally, you know, inhabiting your mother's voice. And so authentically to me, I mean, I've never met your mother, but I just feel like she's there. It's so sensate. It really does give a real force, very, very strong sense of character. And then you're going from her instructions to you to actually interpreting, you know, some vision of how that might be. And I found that completely compelling and so fascinating that you know, I like, for when you first get into the fictional part, it's a shock because her voice is so strong, but then it becomes a fiction.
Yeah.
Do you see it as a fiction?
Yeah, I do. Like, it's the fiction. So the voice is told in multiple voices. So the first part is second person, and then immediately after that it goes into a genre of third person unlimited or third person limited perspective. It kind of reads like a historical fiction, the second chapter.
Yeah.
The second chapter gave me, and Peter said I could say this.
Yes.
The second chapter gave me, I had to put it down because I had this full-on dream afterwards. It's the most compelling book. I absolutely loved this book. And I had this dream that I just was inhabited in the world that Peter creates. And it was a dream of this little boy in a village, and he was pushed into the fire and his sister was trying to save him and he was badly scarred. And anyway, it was just...
And I said, that's actually the relationship between me and my sister.
Metaphorically.
That's right.
Which is interesting. Let's talk about your book too, Maggie, and the form that you take. And it's memoir, obviously, but it's so beautifully structured with these definitions and observations, personal experiences, all intermixed together. And talk about how you decided to create that form. How did you pull that together and the details and the observation in it?
It was an absolute mess, and trying to translate to a non-farming audience what a cast sheep was, or what what crutching was, or what wigging was, or all these, what a race was, all of these different terms that...
Are you just making up words?
Yes. this is why it has definitions in it.
You're from Western Sydney, Peter. You don't know these words, do you?
But you're a good Greek boy and I bet you would enjoy the taste of it.
Yeah. Lamb.
So the structure was really difficult to come up with, and in the end I settled on these sort of three different voices, a traditional memoir voice, which is what I read to you, these crystallisations of my observations of the birds that live around us, we live around them, and they're just little snapshots, and a friend of mine illustrated them so beautifully, and I must say Hamish Penguin have done a gorgeous job with this book. And so then I also had the diary reflections that were a distillation of told in the present tense of the experience of just being out on this on our land and watching the world around us. But yeah, bringing all those three things together was, I ended up printing the manuscript out, cutting it up, colour coding it, laying it out on the floor, trying to find the intersections, which birds fitted in which spot. So
I love the picture. It is a bit like a painting, actually, the book, because you feel the composition of it. I remember Sonia Hartnett telling me, I don't know if many of you know Sonia's work, but beautiful novelist, and she described doing that exact thing once to me, of having all these colour, and she would literally look, so she would represent each character with a different colour piece of paper on a wall, and then she would decide if there was too much of that colour or too little of that colour, and it was just a beautiful way of seeing it. And I felt that when I was reading your book.
That's good. Thank you.
It's lovely. And Susan, back to yours. And yours is probably more of a traditional memoir in the sense that it progresses a story through, but it's actually this telling of a current story too. So you're looking back, but you're actually being present in the novel.
Yeah, and it was interesting as well talking about your pre-published and, you know, post-published book and what you leave out and what you don't. Yeah. My lovely publisher, Annette, is in the audience, and she will know that the first book I presented was, again, like twice as thick, and I had a lot of history in it because I'm not Greek, and also it's an issue for me to know, as Peter is Greek, I didn't want to do this act of cultural appropriation by, you know, presenting someone else's history as though I'm this big person who knows everything. I was very conscious of that, of the sensitivities of that. And so I got a lot of the stuff that I got was from Kytherian people. I'm very, very moved. I became involved with Greece in the first place because I went to school with some Greek girls. And I went to the island of Kythra, which is below the Peloponnese and above Crete. It's one of the Ionian islands, but it's very far removed from the rest of the Ionian islands, which includes Corfu. So I went there for the first time when I was 17. So I have this long history with Kythra.
Love affair.
And love affair. Yeah. And I feel very deeply about it. And I feel very deeply about the story of the people who migrated from that island to here, of which the Komono family was my first introduction. And so I felt a great responsibility to them. To present this story as a non-Kytherian as best as I could. So Annette will know that the first book was like this because it had a lot of oral history, it had history stories, it had stories of the island, which is incredibly rich because it's been colonised by the Phoenicians, by the Venetians. But the problem was, you know, like everyone in the creation of a book, you've got so much material, you've got to order it and you've got to create it. So even though everyone thinks, oh, they know me because I've written all this story down, it's really a crafted thing. So when my first readers read it, my two best friends, they said, oh, it's wonderful. And that's why you give your best friends the book, because they say, oh, it's wonderful. And, you know, you get that. But then Annette read it, and then my agent read it, and they're always saying, well, my agent's less blunt, more blunt than Annette. He said, well, Susan, it shows a lot of promise. Jesus, that doesn't sound good. And Annette, I think they probably had a private conversation. They said, how are we going to tell Susan that what it was when they got to the history bits, in other words, the personal story was strong, too strong. So the personal story, they want to find out what happened, and then they get to the history and they go, fick. We don't want, you know, to get back to the personal story. So that at every point you're judging what are you going to take out and what you know. So I had to make it smaller and smaller and work out what I was doing. Originally I wanted to do psychogeography, like Rebecca Solnit but Rebecca Solnit often won't have as strong a personal story. No. You know, it'll be broader. So the art is working out what you're trying to say.
Yes, and that brings us back to something you told us just before we came on stage, Peter. You know, even to the last minute, you said my copy, you know, was slightly different to yours because there were things you left out. So, again, the art of noticing as a writer is in the editing, even though you get help, obviously, from people.
Yeah.
So tell us that little story and then you might be able to tell us a little bit more about the structure of yours as well. So
I will get to that, but to riff on the noticing stuff and noticing about your culture... So my family's from Lefkada, which is part of the Afghanistan, and the Kitharans have a very specific reputation amongst the Greek diaspora, yes. Which is different to a lot of other people. What I had to notice about asking about my mum's life, and I was asking them questions about their experiences and stuff they take for granted, I didn't understand were cultural objects. So, for example, a lot of our dishes on the island that I come from, they look quite Italian. So we have a traditional pasta dish and we have our traditional peasant dishes, and the idea of Vienna loaf was something very big growing up in my family. I didn't understand why it had such an important role, and the reason for that was because my parents grew up during a time of famine and they lived in subsistence economies where they didn't have monetary exchange. I had to read through an anthropologist that bread was a form of currency,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you would collect a bundle of wood to give to the baker so you could get some bread back and then exchange that for other goods and services. And so that's the kind of stuff I had to reorientate my mind culturally. But one of the things that I did take out, like because my family and the thing that you spoke about, the Greek history stuff, I think Greeks seem to kind of take as an acceptance that everyone is an expert on their history except them, you know. And there's this story about Gough Whitlam going to the Athens Museum and pointing out that they had a vase in the wrong section. And I don't know if he was right or not.
But everyone believed
but that's him. That's so rude, right? Sorry, I know he's
typical
a hero.
Maybe he was the only one tall enough to see it or something.
Yeah. But there was part when I noticed the stuff. There's because I don't draw, like a lot of Greeks, I don't draw distinctions between ancient Greeks and modern Greeks. You know, we inherited their culture. That's our culture. That's our history. And when I say that, I also take all the bad stuff with that too. I don't mean all the good things as well. So on one side of my family, there's rumours and histories of femicide, and I strongly indicate that in the first copy. And in the second copy, I took out one sentence. That's the only edit I made. And so now it reads, it infers the femicide of the family, the femicide that a family member of mine committed in the book. And it's not for legal reasons. It's not for anything like that. I just thought readers should work more.
You made us work. You tell it rather like a fable. There's a real sense of it is Greek history. It's a Greek fable, the way I read it. Mm. Is that your intent?
Yeah, but also more contemporary as well, because there's another chapter as well where my mum's in Athens and she's like just starting university. She's working at a Zacharoplasty and she's dating all these men and she wants to live in a rom-com, and around her the military dictatorship is taking hold. And her little sister was out there throwing little Molotov cocktails. And my mum is out, because I come from a communist family. And my mum is just trying to, like, date a cute boy and settle down. But I wrote it in the style of when Mrs. Dalloway, Virginia Woolf doing Mrs. Dalloway. Mm. But I also looked at the 1970s Greek New Wave cinema when, because, you know, the New Wave cinema thing that was happening in France, no one ever, like, you know, with Alain Delon and all those people, no one ever talks about it actually happening in Greece and other parts of the world at the same time. And so I looked at all the New Wave of the 1970s Greek film, which are available on YouTube, and I incorporated that into that chapter. So I was interested in the contemporary mythologizing of the culture as well.
So Maggie talked about, you know, the beautiful picture she painted literally, you know, with her bits and pieces, and Susan talked about writing this huge tome and editing it back. How did yours build, Peter? Did you did it, did you build it up or did you pare it back? Or did
I didn't know how to write this book, so I just approached it from multiple angles.
Yeah. Did you interview your mum? And
Lots of times.
Yeah.
I interviewed my mum and I've got it recorded on my phone. And I interviewed my auntie because I wanted – her older sister lives here. And so I just got family memories. But this is the thing, right? When you interview older women, they don't reference history so much. Mm. What they do is they talk about – their memories of people and what their experiences were. And so I just, like, my auntie is an amazing cook and my mum is a terrible cook. So it was actually a really good way to have food with my auntie and make her cook for me. Yeah, everyone talks about they love Greek food. I'm like, yeah, so do I. Where can I get some? And, but... one of the interviews, my auntie was... because my mum suffered a disability quite young and my auntie told me this story about remembering my mother after she came out of a year from hospital. And it was a... my auntie sat down on the ground and did the gesture and the physical movement of the way my mum moved with a disability. And it would... she sat down on the ground, she lifted her leg up and she said, when we played as girls... your mother had to move around like that on the ground because they didn't have wheelchairs when it was the village at the time. And it was really sad for me. It was very, because she started crying and then I started crying. And you don't need to give, like, Greeks just any excuse for melancholia, you know what I mean?
Speaking of mothers, Susan, your mother's also... well, your mother is a good cook, or was a good cook, I should say. The relationship in this book between you and your mother is visceral. and as you say, the book didn't end up the way you had planned it in the beginning, you know. So tell us, give us a picture of your mother and writing about your mother.
Well... interesting, you talk about your mother wanted to be in a rom-com. I think Mum also had that approach to life. You know, she would prefer to see everything nice and the surface is nice, and that immediately is a contradiction between us, because I would be wanting to look at the deeper things and Mum would be looking at the surface. She was also incredibly beautiful and she had this big French roll. I was talking about it yesterday. I don't know if anyone heard me. She went the opposite of older women by growing her hair out and having very long silver hair, which she had in this very beautiful French roll. And we're talking about invisibility yesterday, invisibility of older women, but Mum wasn't ever invisible. She was going to make sure that she, you know, everyone knew she was there. So, you know...
she did that in many ways, not just physically.
You know, ultimately, I think what happened was it was a complete dissection of our relationship and for a start, the power imbalances were changed by us going to Greece because I had prior knowledge of the place and the culture and a bit of the language. My comprehension's better than my speech. Mum had travelled before, previously, but as a corporate wife, really. Dad was a businessman, so she travelled in that capacity. So I think the reality of the island was a bit of a shock to her. So, and I was also driving the car, which is one of those metaphors that you know, literally worked, literally and as a metaphor.
That I actually underlined that in the book, that line. It was really fascinating.
So our relationship changed because of the circumstances that and so it became this kind of power struggle in a way. I think for the first time at the advanced age of 62, I sort of separated from my mother in a psychic sense, which sounds very old to do that. But I think, you know, I mean, we've been talking about mothers and daughters, but I think mothers and sons sometimes have a different, you know. I think because mothers and daughters share the female body and the whole over-identification with the female body. I mean, Mum was always criticising me for, you know, whether I was too skinny or too fat or whatever I was. I was never right. So it sort of is an examination examination of that. But at the same time, it's an examination of mother love, you know, mother-daughter love.
Mm. But, you know, you hoped to have this beautiful year with your mum and it didn't quite end up that way, did it? It, as I said in the beginning, it sort of unravelled the story.
Absolutely. Looking back, you know, if I'd only gone in summer, if it had been warmer, maybe the whole different circumstances would have been different. But it was freezing. She found it very difficult just physically to cope with it. She loved certain things. Mum was still a smoker at 85, so she could get Greek cigarettes for like 2 cents a fag, so she'd be fagging away. She loved all that. She loves Greek food, and she was a very good cook. We lived on a farm for the second bit of our time, and so we had seasonal produce, and she would make things out of lemons and, you know, lemon chicken, lemono. She would do lemon soup, lots of things.
But on the whole, she didn't really love the whole experience,
no,
did she?
No. But, you know...
She was not very happy.
No, she wasn't. So it was interesting to experience that and to realise that I'd always thought, I know it sounds really stupid, but I thought that, I mean, I knew my mother was obviously a separate single person than I was a different person, but I thought we had more in common than we actually did.
But this gets back to the art of noticing, because you were noticing the whole way through her different experience than the one you were having. Yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And she wasn't as interested in exploring, you know, the society we were living in and celebrating those differences, or even very much she wasn't really interested in them or noticing them. In that
Maggie, you talk about all sorts of layers of motherhood and mothering. Your own mother, first up, and you mentioned her in that reading. Your own role as a mother, and then, as we've talked about, the sheep, seeing the eyes of motherhood through the sheep. So many passages in this book that I would love you to read. And I don't know if you'd read one short extract, but about that, and you might already have one picked out about that, but I had noted page 91, and there's a ewe and an eagle, and I just thought it was extraordinary for me as a mother and a daughter to empathise so incredibly with the sheep and the cruelty and the things that happened there. So you can read that one if you want, or any other one about the sheep. Yeah.
Excuse the slightly graphic nature of this.
Yeah, no.
Nature is beautiful and brutal. There on a bloodied ewe is an eagle. I get out to open the gate and the bird sees me. It lowers its head, spreads its wings, but does not take off. It's a young sea eagle. Its chest feathers are not yet starched to the crisp white of a mature bird, and it's reluctant to leave its breakfast. We drive towards it, and intimidated at last, it beats its wings until the air fills under them, and then, for a moment, hovers before turning clumsily to roost in the limb of a dead tree. We pull up beside the ewe, expecting the worst, but the ewe has been lucky. The eagle has not been feeding on her, but on her half-born lamb. Our arrival has caused the rest of the mob to drift away, except for a confused day-old lamb who has lost its mother and is sticking close to the cast ewe. The bloodied ewe, who has given herself over to death, doesn't move as I approach. Her exposed udder has been robbed. The waxy seal that forms over an expectant mother's teats is gone, and her bag is soft on the side the opportunistic lamb has sucked. I mutter to the lamb to go and find its real mother. It doesn't move, so I make myself an eagle. I spread my arms and flap at it to drive it away from the cast ewe and towards the mob, where its mother is most certainly. It scampers away from me then and stops uncertain, looking back at the bloodied ewe. I signal for Jay to turn the ute off. The world falls silent. We forget how loud, how intrusive we are. The lamb bleats again, and there at the back of the mob is a ewe turning. She calls loudly to the lamb, who, like a spring released, runs hard towards her.
Thank you. The book captures this experience, and as you said, you wrote the whole diary of that period, you know, of time. Talk to us about observing and help. I mean, you literally helped save lambs. You were part of the mothering and the motherhood. Talk to us about mothering in the context of nature?
Oh, I think that the metaphor it offered me as a writer was exceptional in when you're looking after a whole huge mob. I mean, you know, a couple of thousand ewes that are all lambing at the same within a 6-week period means there's a lot of lambs. And it gave me the opportunity to watch the different ways that ewes mother, and so in turn the way we mother and are mothered. You know, some ewes take to motherhood as naturally as if they were born to it, and other ewes, particularly in a drought year where they're, I mean, we breed selectively to, one of the characteristics we breed for is that they won't leave their lambs. But in a drought situation, nature is saying, leave the lamb and save yourself. So there's these two sort of things working against each other, which I think is really interesting. It's been fascinating listening to both Peter and Susan talk about their mothers. My mother died 19 years ago. Mm. So there's in this book is an examination of approaching an age that my mother was when I, you know, as she, towards the end of her life. She died too young. So it was it's that in itself is an interesting phenomenon, to be an older, to be a mother letting go of my children when I don't have the model ahead of me. I just wanted to comment too on Peter's book about that. One thing that I loved about this book was that it's so funny, it's so brutal, but it's also really, there's just a great sense of humour operating underneath it.
There is in yours too a beautiful voice and some lovely moments, and you know, we really get to know your family in certain ways, you know, and particularly I found your youth with your brother, and you know, there was some really raw and honest but quite, you know, poignant and I wouldn't say funny, but yeah. moments there too. And your mother's role in that is just,
well, talking to that, like the experience of being a mother with a child that is different. And that she never actually got to that place of being able to step away into her own identity afterwards, because how do you step away from a child that needs you and will need you always was really challenging. And my younger brother, who I'm very close with, sort of said to me after I sent him early drafts, and he says like, oh my God, Mags, are we actually allowed to say this? Like in terms of talking about the reality of what it's like growing up with someone who has a different way of moving through the world, and how my mother coped with that.
I think the other thing with the sheep is it made me think that there are good mothers and bad mothers, you know.
Yes, there's a story in there about a ewe. We sit and watch the different mobs in different paddocks through the binoculars, and we actually watched this ewe give birth to nothing around her being disturbed. She was under no pressure, no stress from the mob, nothing was, and she literally gave birth to this lamb and walked off and left it, which makes my partner furious. And she was far enough away from the rest of the mob for us to be able to cut her out. And this lamb's not even up to standing up yet, and she's just literally given birth and walked off. So that's that power of nature saying, this season is too harsh. My best way of surviving is to leave that lamb, and, you know, it's operating on that very elemental level. We caught that ewe, and then I battled with her for about 4 days to convince her that she was going to raise that lamb. and it was very, it was such an interesting, she ended up bonding with the, you know, the hormones got going, and she did raise that lamb. Mm. She got a black disc in her ear so that she was never.
Peter. Never again.
Eugenics,
cut out
huh?
motherhood.
Maybe we should do that to some of us.
Yeah.
Peter, sorry about that. Peter, one of the wonderful refrains in this is about daughters versus sons, and about your mum being, you know, born into a family of women, really. Can you talk to that and the role of women and mothers?
My mother comes from 5 girls. And back in the time when there was a village in no running water and electricity, her father insisted that all the 5 girls get an education, which was quite unheard of. And he tailored each of their educations based on their specific skill set. So it resulted in some quite amazing women, and What's interesting about that is the generation afterwards, all the daughters of the five girls have minimum 2 degrees each. And so it's that old saying of you educate men and you educate men, but you educate women and you educate generations and generations beyond that. I do want to speak to that, like, refrain of motherhood and what's a good mother and what's a bad mother, because I've met a lot of mothers who just didn't really feel that hormone kick in personally for them, so they were, like, stuck raising this, like, child, whatever, and they didn't have that other part kick in. And my mother gets a lot of criticism for having children and just being a terrible cook.
My mother was too.
But what do you want? Like, what do you want from them? Do they have to do everything? Do they have to raise these shitty, ungrateful brats? Do they have to cook? Do they have to clean? Do they have to have a job? Do they have to have a career? Like, this is the thing about noticing. I have a theory that the reason I like writing female women characters like my mother and my sister is because I can see them as people and I don't have any ulterior motive for them. And why does the... Like, I know it's bad in sheep to not raise your young, but then part of me is also just like, well, you know, why does everyone have to breed, you know?
It's... Peter, it's so fascinating. Like, I'll stand there and watch a mob of sheep walk over, you know, sheep's fallen over and the rest of the mob just walks straight over the top of them. Mm. Or, you know, there's a lost lamb and there's mothers ewes there that couldn't raise that lamb but they don't. And I think, oh, gosh, the difference between sheep, us and sheep, is that we would step in and not walk over that, you know.
Well,
but then I come to the city and find myself walking past people that are...
All the time.
And
but, you know, the other thing about motherhood as well is, like, one thing I learned about writing this book is that I think as children we either revere or hate our parents or blah, 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 blah. And I think it's something me and my sister are going through at the moment. It's just realising that we're not the cause of our parents' problems. We're just the symptoms of it. And most people... And, you know, as a child you think you're the centre of the world. And some people never ever get over that wound, you know, always trying to solve your parents' problem. And I think one of the great things...
Always blaming.
Always blaming and solving their parents', you know. And it's like, I know people who had, you know, heroin mummies and all that stuff, and it's not their fault, you know. None of that stuff is their fault. Like, it's... They just had a shitty experience. And, you know, part of being a human being, you know, living in a society, is we should forgive people and, you know, try and understand when they do really bad things. As mothers, we should try and understand why they're doing that rather than shift to blame to hold them up to the Mother Mary, as we do, you know.
Look, I just wanted to, because we're starting to... That's my timekeeper here. Where are we up to? I think we're starting to get towards the end of our time, and sadly. But I just want to talk... You give your characters very unusual names, and we need to talk to it. And I just wanted you to read a tiny passage which is not necessarily about motherhood, but it just shows your observation of details. And it's actually on page 95. I haven't even asked Peter to do this yet. He's got a brand new copy there.
It might not be different. What's it about?
Here, I'll give it to you. Yeah, starts with that, just that bit.
That bit?
Yeah.
The highlighted? The home that clear-voiced lived in was made up of three rooms closed off by accordion doors. Onan saw these doors as a change from her familiar village hut. She slept in the room that doubled as the living space. The cot became a seat when she wasn't sleeping there. The fabrics of the home had florals on them, curtains with large and cheeky roses, blankets, fluffy white and yellow daisies. All the fabrics had the shimmer of the outdoors. She thought them as a rural family living in their city, their decorations reflecting their longing.
Yeah, it's just this beautiful sense of observation of the tiny little things that we see all the time. But did you notice those two names, Clear Voiced and Honoured? And it mightn't have jumped out at you, but they're the names of the characters. Mm. Where did they come from?
What I did was I found people's Greek names and I interpreted them in English based on their meaning. My name isn't Peter. I have a baptismal name and it's loosely translated as forever health. And my sister, her name in the book is Resurrection, which is Anastasia. My mother and my father both have the same male and female name. The same name, but it's in male and male, female. They're actually named after one of our island saints. Their name is loosely translated honoured. If you do it with George, the name would be farmer. So I just took the Greek words and their meanings and I interpreted them in English because that's actually how you would hear them in Greek.
That's lovely. And because we are drawing in, I just wanted Susan to give us a little bit of a sense. One of the other things that is a continuity between your three books is nature, obviously, and the observations of that. And I think you might have read a bit of this yesterday, so apologies to anyone that was there, but it was page 154 here. Have you got that there?
Oh, sure.
And just a short bit to give you a sense of a lot of Susan's book is set in winter when it's cold and her mother's very unhappy. And then there's a little moment where there's spring and things come to life. And
now the earth tilted on its axis. Now Kithara woke up. Fields of red poppies bright against the ground, wild yellow crocuses spilling like sunshine downhills. Everything trapped was suddenly free, stretching its limbs, breathing out. What had been asleep was now wide-eyed, trees unfurling, strung with tender new leaves. The natural world lit up, the sky, the wild barren mountains. There was nowhere your eyes turned which wasn't filled with colour and brightness. White blossom, pink, cherry red, everything joyously bursts forth, festive, laden. Flowers and plants exploded in unabashed lustiness. Purple crocuses mixed with yellow, orchids, asphodels, caper flowers, wild violets, starry wild garlic, ripening figs, puffs of wild artichoke. Those nameless spring flowers I had seen since our arrival, now proliferating in great swathes in fields and along roadsides, growing through the cracks of buildings. On a walk, I asked someone what they were called, wild snapdragons. Some were yellow or pink, others purple or the palest mauve. Together, the flowers turned Kithara into a blaze of colour, and you only had to walk a few hundred metres to gather armfuls.
Thank you. So there's a real beauty in all of these books too. And I just wanted to finish off by just saying, what were the things you had to leave out of this? Was there unspoken? Were there things, I mean, I know you spoke about that a little bit before, Peter, but in the big picture, what did you choose to omit? To leave out?
Well, many things, actually, many things. For the purposes of the narrative, mine also takes place over a year. So I did press together some timelines. But really the thing was I was very concerned that the moral and ethical question, unlike you being fiction, I think you may have had this issue too. I wanted to protect my children, Maggie. I didn't want to put anything that would embarrass them, and also my mother. She wasn't there to speak for herself, so
passed away since the book came out.
Yes, yeah. And even though she had passed away, I still felt a duty to protect her in some way and not to make her ashamed in any way. So there were things, you know, there were other events that I didn't put in. There was also events like, not to give away the ending, but there's a very significant thing happened. My ex-husband came out battled through. We had to get a letter from the Queensland government because of COVID to get him to Australia to care for me, which was amazing because I was ill at the end of the writing of the book. So there are many, many things that I chose. Originally I did put that in, but it unbalanced the book too much. And then I knew everyone would be interested in asking me questions about, you know, am I getting back together with my ex-husband? So I left all that out. So many things is the answer.
Yeah. And considering other people's views of what you're writing?
Oh, absolutely. You've got to... it's a really hard line, you know, to be authentic and tell the truth as much as it's a truth, aware that it's not the truth, capital T, capital T. It's your version of something that happened. I was very aware that my version of events may have... probably, you know, would have differed from other people's interpretation of events. So you are very conscious of that all the time. And, you know, it's something that you wrestle with. I talk about in many ways, all it can actually be is a narrative of spaces. Mm. You know, it can't actually be the whole story.
Mm. Maggie?
Oh, just very quickly. I think in trying to whittle the book down to its essence, I really hope that if memoir is successful, it's almost as if I'm not in the memoir, even though I am the eye on the page is leading you through it. I hope that by stripping it back so that there's an essence of experience there, as people are reading it, they are inserting themselves into that experience and I become invisible, I hope. Mm. So I guess in editing, that's something that I'm really working towards, that sense of invisibility on the page, even if there is a profound I there.
Mm. Right. And you did make some decisions like certain people only have initials for their names and, you know, there's obviously some sensitivities around when you write it as well.
Oh, the people don't care. But I love using the letters because then the only named things are animals and the letters make me feel like you can skim over that. You don't have such a strong sense of the person with a name. So if it's a letter, there's a sense that the reader has a wider capacity to build a picture of themselves in that moment, how they might experience that moment.
Yeah. And Peter, anything more to add to that about your book and...
Yeah, just because in terms of the question, what did I leave out and what did I leave in, I think because I wrote this book for the Greek community and it is a book about our histories and our traumas and our violences and our domestic violence and family conflict, I always didn't care so much about my ethics because I saw it as providing a social service, as a document for... Mm. A bunch of women who you only see in mass culture as a punchline.
On that note, would you join with me in thanking these three wonderful writers?
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.